as I've gotten older now, money for me is really more about freedom and about mostly time freedom, being able to control your own calendar, hang around the people who you want to hang around with, all of that stuff. I think money unlocks that for you. That's why it's important to me.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is a dear friend and a fellow author and investor, Jake Taylor. He trusted me once with his life during a sailing trip in some rough seas. Today, Jake shares the memory of his great-grandmother, who instilled in him his interest in saving, meeting Warren Buffett, who fired up his passion for investing, and life experience that ultimately led him to the pursuit of freedom. Jake Taylor is the CEO of Farnham Street Investments. He's also the host of various web series and podcasts, 5 Good Questions, The Hikecast, and Value After Hours. Jake is the author of a very successful book, The Rebel Allocator. He has an MBA in finance and accounting from UC Davis. We will talk about the importance of saving, a life-changing meeting with the legendary investor Warren Buffett, Jake's best-selling book, The Rebel Allocator, his thoughts on the success and abundance of a free market economy, Jake's new venture, Journalytic, and the importance of journaling while investing. Please help me welcome Jake Taylor. Thank you for joining me today, Jake. You and I go back 7 years or so. You managed to talk me into several interviews over those years. And you and I had many phone calls, many walks on the beaches of the world, and many incredible chats. And many times I wished somebody was recording it. So today, let's pretend that nobody's listening, but we're actually recording.
Yeah, I wish I was on the beach with you and we were having this actually on the beach, but this is a good second.
We'll have a special limited edition that we'll do on the beach or on a hike next time.
Okay.
So first of all, I'm curious about your upbringing and your childhood, and how do you think that shaped your relationship with money?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know if I've unpacked it all that much. So I had a great-grandmother who was very influential early in my life. I was around her a lot. And, you know, being born in 1907, like she went through the Great Depression as a young adult and came out of it, I think, a very conservative in a financial sense, seeing how bad things could get and always wanting to save for a rainy day. I think I absorbed a lot of that. It's always really hard to unpack. Is it nature versus nurture? But I remember even before going to kindergarten, I would get these little tubs that margarine or butter would come in, the little plastic tubs. And I had 4 or 5 of them. And I wrote on there with a Sharpie, spending, savings, gifts, and then something else. But basically, I was trying to categorize my spending. And I would put, every time I got a little bit of money, I would divvy it up into the tubs and kind of keep them organized that way. And so I always liked to keep track of it and liked counting. And I've had a net worth spreadsheet that I've kept up for, I don't know, it's going on 20 years now. And every month I kind of go calculate what my net worth is and input it and update the chart. And it's fascinating to see it, because I can see like points in my life of different things that happened. And oh, that's where I got married and it was very expensive and the net worth went down a bunch. But then over time, as this chart gets bigger and longer, like you almost can't even see that little blip anymore. But at one point, it was sort of a big blip. Anyway, I've always kind of intrinsically enjoyed keeping track of it and counting. And I think as I've gotten older now, money for me is really more about freedom and about mostly time freedom. Being able to control your own calendar, hang around the people who you want to hang around with, all of that stuff, I think money unlocks that for you. I think that's why it's important to me.
Was there anything that you had to unlearn that you learned as a kid and then you realize this is not serving you anymore?
I would say that early on, I had kind of a little bit too much of a deferred life mentality. So saving such an extreme rate where I probably was leaving some early life on the table, that like some trips I could have done or things I probably should have been doing that would have smoothed out some of the consumption over time. And recognizing that life is relatively short, a big wake-up call was losing a close friend when I was in my early 30s. And he, same age as me, ended up passing away very suddenly. And it was like, wow, this, nothing is guaranteed here in life. And I can't just let that time and that experience slip away because of trying to be too miserly with money.
A lot of investors talk about how they got started in investing. The book they picked up, which is my story, the interview they heard,
yeah,
or the person they met. Very few people ask about the why investing. I mean, you could have been in any other field, and you have been for a period of time, but why have you decided to devote so much of your time, so much of your life and attention to investing?
I would say for me, it was a lot of it was just pure luck and kind of circumstance. I had always been into money and investing, but I couldn't say that I had much of a framework, really. I had money in mutual funds. I saved. I had a 401k working at a job. But meeting Warren Buffett early in business school, I happened to win this lottery for a group of students to go to Omaha and visit him. Obviously, being totally blown away by him, I knew a little bit about him going into it, but I didn't really understand his framework. And so once I started to unpack that through reading different books, to Ben Graham, to Munger, to all these other investors who we kind of all love, I realized, oh, they're just trying to get a good deal on something. Like, they just don't want to pay retail. And I had always had that mentality the whole time. I just didn't know that when you applied that to the partial ownership of businesses, they had a name for that, and it was called value investing. It just made perfect sense to me right away. And then the process of learning more about business, and I find investing to be kind of this ultimate puzzle that's so multidisciplinary, because it is economics and business, psychology, even biology in a lot of ways. Like, it crosses so many boundaries, and being able to fit that all these puzzle pieces together is just infinitely fascinating to me. So I was hooked after that. And so it took me several years to transition out of my corporate job that I was doing and into a full-time investor role. But once I was able to do that, and it's been really awesome, and I feel very fortunate to have gotten to that place.
Would you say that it would be equally interesting to you to solve the intellectual side of the puzzle without the money side, or they have to coexist for you to stay in the field?
Well, you know, that being a true value investor for the last 5 years, I've actually had a chance to run that scenario and see what it actually feels like to execute a process that you think is sound and not get the result that you were looking for. It's a bit more about lagging a market as opposed to actually like losing money. But in general, I think when you go into it, you have these dreams of, oh man, I'm going to do really well, and sort of wants to beat the market if they're being honest with themselves when they first get into it, right? That's what everyone is thinking about. But as I think over time, as you get more philosophical about it, I think you'd start to realize, well, that's, I'm not trying to run that race anymore. I just want to do a good job of managing the money and in a risk conscious way that provides a good experience actually for your investors, as opposed to just, I got to go beat the market. But I have found that yes, the intellectual exercise experience of the learning is still very satisfying to me, and enough to overcome the negative feelings of sometimes feeling like, God, do I know what I'm doing? Is the game different today than it was 10 years ago? Mr. Market will always question or make you question yourself at some point in your career. It would have been probably better if it was been a little bit later in my career, but you know, it's good to get it out of the way, I guess, and know that you can probably get through it and to the other side and still have your soul intact.
You're in a race of your own. You're not competing with anybody else. It's your own path, and that seems to help you.
Yeah, I mean, it really helps a lot too, is untangling from the rat race of the market and the constant news flow and just this, what's the Fed going to do every 2 seconds? That's, which has characterized what, to me at least, like what it's felt like a lot for the last, boy, 10 years, I guess. But going back then to, okay, here's the business that I own. This is the CEO that's running it. Here are their customers. Here are their suppliers. These are the environments that they're doing business in. Like, here's the actual things that they're creating that people buy because it's making their lives better. Getting really back to the business fundamentals really helps me to sleep easier at night and not worry so much about all of the macro craziness that's going on. And if you hang on every single little news item in the macro world, it's just so exhausting. So going back to the businesses is how I keep a lot of my sanity.
I keep hearing how we're living in uncertain times. And I always wonder, was there a time when things were not uncertain?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's every moment feels like it's its own special, unique history. But then when you go back and look at them through the lens of history or even your own journaling and look back at it, and it feels much smaller than it did in the moment. I've tried to do this before in real time to imagine what are the things that we're going to look back on in 10 or 15 years and say, oh, that was important, or this wasn't important. And it's actually incredibly difficult to do. There's a lot of things that seem, okay, this has got to be one of the big deals, right? And then it turns out like, no one even remembers that. It was nothing. Is that how you feel too?
It's very tricky with individual investments and the market overall. When you're managing other people's money, you have to take into account their concerns. When you hear about the uncertain times and things that are on their mind, it's a fascinating pursuit to figure out what's really important, what should have an impact on the portfolios, and what's just noise. And I think that's the hardest part, because if you focus on the noise, you might really miss out on wonderful opportunities that appear right in front of you. And it helps to be patient, because there's so much of the outside stimulation of everything that we think we should be worried about day to day.
The other thing I find that's difficult is that as an investor, you have to eat your emotions a lot of times internally and be able to suppress them and not have to like get too out of control based on like this, it's stimuli that's coming in. If you had your head stuck in an MRI machine while you're reading all this stuff, it would show your amygdala firing and that your fear sensors are going, and it triggers actually like the same response as if like you saw a rustling in the bushes and thought it was a snake. And that's the type of fear that you're dealing with. And what is difficult is that actually, like, it's not so hard to manage your own emotions, I don't think, relatively speaking. You also, as a professional investor, have to eat all the emotions of your investors as well. And their fears are pushing into your amygdala, and you're having to calm both yourself and them as well. And I think the very good investors who are good at managing their clients are very good at absorbing that energy and dissipating it and letting it just run to ground and not impact the system overall. And that takes a special, I think, kind of deep-seated sense of self-worth and confidence that you know what you're doing, and an emotional stability to have that kind of emotional sink where you can send energy to it and have it just be dissipated out, like, and not come in and fry all the circuits of the system.
I often think of learning the basics of finance and economics at school. And obviously, nobody talks about the client, about the person that's behind the portfolio. You're just picking stocks. They fit certain criteria, and it's supposed to work according to all kinds of models that were developed by people that never managed money professionally. And then you realize there are human beings behind the portfolios, and they have to sleep well. They'll give you a call when they're nervous, and you play a certain role in their lives. And when the market sells off, we get calls.
Yeah.
Clients call and say, I know what you're doing. You're probably buying things, but I just wanted to hear your voice. And I think that's a great lesson, a very powerful thing to know, but that's not something taught at school at all. And I think it's overlooked by the profession in general.
I think about this a lot because if you think about the product that you're offering as a professional investor that has clients, you may have a better mousetrap that allows you to, let's say you put up 20% returns, but the volatility of the getting to that 20% is so extreme that you buck off all of your investors and no one actually comes along for you on that ride, that it's actually not a very good product. And so even if you could detune a little bit of the volatility that led to a less optimized outcome, but a greater chance of investors being able to come with you on that outcome, I think on a dollar weighted basis that you're actually providing a better product, a better service to your customers than someone who ended up higher in the return profile, but that didn't bring anyone along with them.
Jake, when people talk about returns or show returns, I'm always curious how they got there. And as you said, if you're managing your own money and you went through a lot of ups and downs, that's something that you have to handle. But clients, they might not be happy to be on a journey like that. just to get to those returns. So that's part of the conversation that gets completely lost. The returns is the only thing that people talk about, but not how they got there.
Yeah. And I think if you looked at historic, like dollar weighted returns, there's a lot of investors who have kind of guru status who, if you look at their returns, actually, like the returns look great, but the when money was there and when money wasn't there, and when the returns happened, it's actually been like kind of a disaster for their investors. So what I mean by that is that they had great returns when no one was in there because no one knew about them. And then the kind of the cat gets out of the bag and all this money comes in, and then they underperform dramatically and no one makes any money there. In fact, there's a lot of losses, and then everybody leaves, and then they start doing better again. And this cycle just happens over and over again. And it's not the investor, the manager's fault necessarily. This is sort of one of the problems with hot money and the performance chasing that we see in this. There's always so much you could do if you're trying to run a business as a professional manager. It's very difficult to find the people who actually come in and stay in when they're supposed to and actually give you more money when you're down, when you are about to probably find some reversion to the mean and start doing better again. They're just harder to find. And so it's not their fault, but it's a kind of one of the more grotesque outcomes that this industry creates that no one really talks about. Dollar-weighted returns are actually often terrible compared to what the track record looks like on the chart of 10,000 invested in this year. What does it look like in 30 years from now? It looks great, but yet no one actually made any money on a, across the LP base overall.
You're right. And some people get it and understand it, and I think it's a blessing. And some people come around after a while, and others chase the next hot thing, whether it's a stock or a theme or investment style. If you had a chance to start over your investment career, what would you have done differently, Jake?
Yeah, that's a good question. I got interested in value investing in 2006-07, let's call it, time period. And value as a strategy had one of its best outperformance periods from 2000 to 2007. In a sense, I was a momentum chasing value investor. I just didn't know it, right? Of course, it's going to work to buy 50 cent dollars. It makes perfect sense. And of course, it's been working. And of course, I'm going to do it. And of course, I'm going to do really well because I'm that smart, right? I think you have to, any investor has to recognize that if you get attracted to the investment game, chances are whatever it is that attracted you to it and whatever you're into is hot at that time period and is most likely about to cool off. And you're probably like the last person in on this gravy train. So I had no idea about that going into it. So I should have been expecting that there was going to be reversion to the mean, that value was going to have a difficult period for quite a while. And then I should have just been ready for that if I would have a better understanding of how these cyclical things happen. I definitely would tell my younger self this. Hey man, you're getting sucked in at the top because it's been working. And if it's going to be a little bit of wandering through the desert to get back to the other side of when it might start working again. So buckle up.
No, I love it. I love your answer. And you're stealing my next, well, my following question, but we'll come back to it. Tell me more about your book. I'm a huge fan of your book. I really enjoyed it. I actually reread it recently.
How's that hold up?
I think it's brilliant every time I look at it. I find something different that catches my attention each time I read it. But it's a different book than a lot of investment books. It's a novel. It's not a memoir. I'm curious why you chose this kind of delivery of your ideas. And then I have to ask you this. How much of the main character, Nick, is Jake Taylor himself?
The inspiration for the book was a few things. Number one, being an investor, and really being a huge Buffett fan, like one of his great insights was the importance of capital allocation when it comes to business success. And so what does that mean? It means what does the business and the decision makers inside the business decide to spend their money on? And I would see these decisions that were being made and I would say, this makes no sense. Why is the CEO doing this right now? And it would drive me nuts because I'm the owner of this business and I feel like they're making stupid decisions with my money. What can we do here to help them understand and make a better decision? And so the book lays out a lot of the framework of capital allocation that would just at least help you think through what your options are. It doesn't give you any kind of answer. Hopefully what it gives the decision maker in a business is the confidence to choose their own path in a way that lets them make a smart decision for their business, as opposed to just following what everyone else is doing, which is the herd-like behavior that I was seeing. So the other thing that I wanted to do with the book was to hopefully inspire younger people to have some appreciation for the good that capitalism provides in a day-to-day context of everything around you that makes your life easier and better is often a product of capitalism. And I felt like the tide had kind of swung somewhat in one direction away from that. And I wanted to do my little part to maybe just raise some awareness of some of the good things that come from it. So, and then why tell it in a story? Well, I actually wrote a nonfiction book proposal and had a book offer from a publisher to do this book. I thought it was going to be so boring by the time I just was like, I don't know how I'm going to make this interesting enough to make it a good read. So, and there were all these little nudges from the universe about the importance of storytelling and how that is the sugar that helps the medicine go down. And so I started over and had all these cap allocation lessons that were ready to go, but I needed to tell a story about it. And so I wasn't sure even how to do that. And so I thought, who's good at telling stories? I thought, well, Hollywood seems to be reasonably good about that. So I went and I read a couple books about screenplays and how to write a screenplay. So I basically wrote a screenplay of the book and then filled it out as a book. And so that's why it reads kind of like a movie in a way that helps teach the lessons in a way that's hopefully a little bit more entertaining. And then as far as the character and the overlap, there are definitely overlapping things that I took from my own history, but I took a lot of liberties too as literary devices to make the story have more oomph to it. So for instance, the main character's background is that his parents are very kind of bleeding heart liberal socialist mentality. Well, that's my parents aren't that way, but that was a literary device for me to pull the bow back for this character as far as possible so that he has the longest arc to travel to find this appreciation of capitalism. There are some things in there that are real. They say to write what you know. So I tried to pick some things that actually happened in real life so that I didn't have to just create these magical worlds in my head, which I'm not creative enough to do.
You and I have known each other for a while. I know that you are a huge fan of a free market economy, broadly defined. I grew up in a communist country, so I can tell you why I'm a fan. But you grew up in the United States, and you still have a huge appreciation for the free market economy. Can you tell me where it came from, and was it always the case, or a certain experience or a person made you think that way? And don't tell me it was me, because I know well that you felt this way before we met.
I think that's one of the things that you and I bonded most early on, was that I have a lot of friends actually who are non-US, and we bond over this because they have such a better appreciation for someone who was born into it, as someone who had to come from the outside to see all of the supermarket that's stocked full of stuff was this very visceral reminder of this amazing bounty that's provided, that's harnessed by capitalism. In my early 20s, I read some books that were influential on me that were leaned towards free markets and thinking, free speech, that were helpful in opening it up. But I think my appreciation didn't really get to the depth that it's gotten to until I understood more about complex adaptive systems and biology and nature. And just recognizing that there are so many unintended consequences when a centralized authority tries to control a complex system.
You don't believe that there's somebody, a wise person sitting in a tower that knows exactly what everybody should be wearing and eating and how they should be spending their days?
Every single person, let's say there's millions of us, we all have in our head this little calculus that's happening of what is the next thing that we want or need. And we make subjective utility calculations all the time inside of our heads of, oh, I'm hungry right now, or, oh, I want this particular shirt. Oh, my fashion sense has changed. I want this other shirt. Or I want to live in this house now without a pool because I have young children, but now that they're older, I wish I had a pool. And now so we're all making these little individual calculations at all times of what is the next thing that we want. How could anything have that understanding of what's inside of our heads about what we want next, and have this idea that they would know what it is that you want, what color shoe do you want that day, what color socks, So, I mean, it's preposterous to think that there's any man in a tower that could understand all these millions of calculus problems that are happening inside of our heads at all times about the subjective wants and needs of humanity. It's when you think about it like that, it's just so, it's asinine.
Well, it's music to my ears, and I hope more people feel that way and are listening to you and taking it to their hearts. I'm curious about your process. Every investor has their routine and ritual, and I'm very curious, if we were to be a fly on a wall in Jake's office for a day or a week, what would we see? And I'm curious how your new venture, Journalytic, how does that fit into your daily life and your investment process? Can you share more?
You'd be very disappointed. It'd be very boring if you were a fly on the wall. You'd want to watch it at 10x speed, but because it's a lot of reading at the end of the day. It's a lot of looking at 10Ks. It's a lot of reading books that are often outside of the investment sphere, looking for insights that I can apply then to the investing world. Because I think that if you're reading the same investment books as everyone else, it's unlikely that you're going to find that differentiated viewpoint that is going to give you the insights that no one else has about a particular business. And that's where you really get paid well in the investment game, is when you have a differentiated insight that no one else has. And then eventually everyone gets that same insight that you had. That's how you get paid. With Journalytic, I had a process where I would take a lot of notes and they would just kind of be all over the place. And I had a lot of communications with friends and investor friends and people that were looking at similar businesses to me. And I would just, you're trading a ton of emails, it's Twitter DMs, it's all over the place. It's WhatsApp. It's a mess. And I had a checklist that I would run that lived in a Google Doc. It was just about slowing myself down to make sure I'm looking at all of the little things about a business, and I'm not going to get blindsided by something that I just sort of like, I knew to check for, but I just forgot, which is what happens all the time. And Bogey, I know that you, your adventurous lifestyle that you lead and being a pilot, I'm sure you could speak to the power of checklists as far as a takeoff checklist and how easy it would be to miss something important if you didn't follow that checklist every single time.
You don't want to.
No. And so as an investor, that same thing applies to us. And it really, there's a biology to this. Like our brains are always seeking to use the minimum amount of glucose that they can get away with. So the checklist is a way to short circuit that particular evolutionary outcome where you want to conserve glucose and make you do the hard work. And so I had this process that was kind of all over the place, notes all over the place, checklists in Google Docs, write-ups. It was unmanageable. And I knew a lot of other investors had that same problem. And so I sat down and I thought, okay, if I was going to do this from first principles, let's start over and build from scratch. What would it look like to have a great place to journal all my thoughts, to take notes, to record all my decisions? And that's actually like the most important thing, is writing down my decisions and why did I do them. And so I started working on sketching this all out, and it turned out that there are all of these best practices about decision making and about investing that a lot of people know about, but that aren't actually doing them on a day-to-day basis. They're not journaling, they're not recording their decisions, they're not running checklists, they're not making contracts with themselves to do things that they know are in their best interests. But yet when it comes time to actually pull the trigger, it's scary to do that. You have these best intentions that you're not following often the times because you get scared or whatever. It feels like the circumstances changed from before. Well, when I started working on all these and like making this into a cohesive set of tools, I realized, oh my God, there's like a whole business here of that would help other investors if they started working on this also and using these tools. And at the end of the day, what it's really about is recording all of your thoughts in here so that you can get feedback on them and close the feedback loop and really start to learn more about yourself. And so that was the impetus for Journalytic. It's like basically built for all of the places that I knew I was making mistakes and where I wasn't recording things that I kind of wanted to know about my own process, and making it easier to capture those things so I can learn about where I'm going wrong, and then I won't make the same mistakes over and over again, which is what you're banished to doing that unless you're actively working on your investment process at all times. And so I'm very fortunate. I have a couple of co-founders who are just absolute rock stars and are helping me. And we've got a handful of employees, mostly developers, who are helping me build this out. And I'm hoping to launch the actual public product within probably less than 2 months, probably before the end of the year. So let people get in there and try it out and see what they like about it and build something for investors that's really inspired by investors and what they need. So I'm incredibly excited about it. I think it's going to be really cool. And I've been using it personally for, you know, kind of more rudimentary version of it, especially early on, but for about a year and a half now. And it's absolutely taken my game to another level, I think. Like, I'm way more diligent. I'm way more process driven than I was before. I think the insights are going to just keep coming more and more because I have more and more data about my process that's getting accumulated. And it's been a game changer for me already. So I think it might help other investors too.
It sounds like an accountability coach in a sense. You can see what you thought you knew. And it's a challenge for investors because looking back and not writing it down in the moment, we think we knew something at the time or we knew that we would do it, but we didn't.
Oh, it's shocking to go back and read your old entries and see the bias that was there once you have a little bit more time on it. To go back to what we were talking about with history and what was going to be important and what wasn't. To go and see that in real time after seeing what you were thinking in real time after the fact and not have your brain protect your ego, which is what's happening with hindsight bias, where you when you go back and look, oh man, I was so stupid about that, but I've learned now. Whereas if you don't write it down and don't journal about it, your brain will reconfigure the memory to protect your ego and make you think, oh yeah, of course I knew that back then. That was obvious. Everyone knew that, right? But no one knew. It's shocking. I mean, it is absolutely shocking to have the mirror held up in front of your face like that. But at the end of the day, isn't that what you want, is to know where reality is and what is the truth of this situation, even if it's a little painful? I think that's where growth comes from. And I think it's going to be really hard to learn and grow and become a better investor at the same rate if you're not doing things like this to work on your process.
I love it. It really matters, at least in my mind, when an investor decides to start their journey. And if they start during a bear market or a bull market, it has some sort of an impact on how they think. I'm curious when you started and if you think that the starting point matters and has some influence on how you end up investing in your life.
I do think that there is something to that. I think there's kind of an imprint that can happen to an investor depending upon when did they cut their teeth. And I think for me, in the 2006-2008 timeframe, I saw how prices could go down. And I saw actually like how unreasonably cheap businesses can trade for when everyone is afraid. The deals that can be thrown off. And you know where that ends up being, like where the left tail outcomes. So if you imagine the distribution of outcomes, and on the left tail are all the bad things. Oh my God, this company was a disaster. Their factory burned down. Their biggest customer left. There's all these things that can go wrong. And then on the right tail is all the things that could go right that no one ever anticipated. And maybe over there, it's you're running a break-even retail business online and you discover that cloud computing is this amazing thing and you invent AWS. And that's a right tail outcome. In that down period of 2006-2008, I saw how bad things could get for some companies. And that makes me very risk averse to too much debt because I saw, oh my God, when a company gets out over their skis with too much debt, like there's bankruptcy risk that can actually happen. I know that a lot of people don't really think about bankruptcy anymore because, you know, we actually statistically have a lot less bankruptcy than we did for, you know, history before that. A lot of that has to do with very low interest rates and the ability to refinance debt. But I've seen what can go wrong with a business, and I've also seen it how cheap a business can trade. And so that made me want to get that same kind of deal for the last 10 years. And frankly, there just haven't been as many of those kind of deals in the last 10 years. And so you end up sitting out a lot of, you don't buy businesses because there were a lot of things that I wanted to own, and they'd start to come down in price towards me, and then they'd bounce and then move away, and I never got to own them. And it was like, every single time it'd start to get down towards where I thought it was attractive, oh, there it goes again. It ran away from me. And this sort of my level of buy the dip was so much lower than everyone else's because of when I started and saw how cheap things could get, I often missed out on a lot of these ricochets back up. If I think if you were born into a bull market and cut your teeth there, I think that you could be wired then to recognize where the right tail outcomes, like all the amazing things that can happen. And then you're therefore looking for those, and sometimes you'll find them. And like that is a perfectly legitimate way to go about investing in this business. It just doesn't happen to be my particular way. And I think a lot of that has to do with when did I start out.
In both cases, there's a blind spot for those that start in the bear market. They might not appreciate things that can go up quickly and grow. And those that got spoiled by a bull market, they have a blind spot because they haven't seen things go bad.
Yeah, they haven't seen it at the ridiculously low prices that businesses can trade at for long times, too. Like, that's the other study of history that shows you it's not normal to just go down and then bounce like a golf ball off the cart path. There are lots of times in history of markets where things stayed cheap for a decade and just it got cheaper on you the whole time. And it was just like was gut-wrenching. You were down. There'd be like a rally and it would break your heart with a new low after that. And then another rally and then a new all-time low. And it was just those type of markets that just are soul-crushing. There's a lot of investors who haven't lived through those. And honestly, even 2008 wasn't, it was a reasonable amount of time. I think the market peaked in late 2007 and didn't bottom until March of 2009. So you had a reasonable amount of time, but there were other places in history, if you look at it, where you had much longer stretches of just heartbreaking rallies to the point where like people start to talk about, oh, you can't own equities. That's a dead place to go, right? And that's usually when you find the real bottoms, and that's when you create sort of a generational bull market ingredients, is that's what it looks like. And so I don't think we've had that in quite a while, at least in my opinion.
I'm curious about your definition of success. I know that you're someone that likes to talk in terms of odds and bads, and you love to quantify things. That's one aspect of Jake that I know. So I'm curious what success means to you and how do you measure success?
I think to be very good at this, at the investing game, it's important to make probabilistic predictions about what you think the future is going to look like. And not think about in absolute binary yes or no's, because that's never the way that the world works. There's lots of different paths that the universe can take, and we just happen to only see one of them. The universe contains multitudes, and there's lots of different ways that the ping pong balls could bounce. So I think you have to think probabilistically, especially in the investment game. And it's especially important because you don't really have all of the information ever. You as an outside owner of a business never have all of the information. Even when you're inside the business, you don't have all the information. It's just impossible. So you have to keep a degree of uncertainty in your mind that I don't know everything about this. And so I really need to think about the different ways that this can go. So humans are not very good at this, by the way, unless you actually write some of this stuff down. Like you have to force yourself to think through it. We tend to want to just think about yes or no. And then when it happens, it was obvious. And if it doesn't happen, it was obvious it wasn't going to happen, right? So now, as far as success goes, it's kind of a hard question and something that I think I'm actually not very good at. And I think it's detrimental to my life and I work on it, but I'm still not very good at it. And that I tend to live in the future a lot. Like I think about what's the next project that I want to work on? What's the next fun thing that, or the next trip or the next conversation or the next book I want to read? And I don't spend as much time as I should in the present. And that's kind of where success lives. Like success is a measurement of what did you do? And I don't really think very much about it. I tend to just like, oh, hey, that was a win. And I'm moving on. What's the next thing? Or, oh, that was a loss. Okay, let's move on to the next thing. And I'm envious of people a little bit who can live more in the present and enjoy their whatever it is success that they're having. But I don't spend much time there. I'm just always thinking about what's next and what would be a fun project to work on. So I'm not a very good person to answer this question, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Success for you, it's a journey, not a destination. It's not returns, performance, net worth, assets under management. It's none of those. What I'm hearing, it's more of a journey and appreciation for it.
It's definitely none of those. It is something else. It's more related to, did I feel like I made my little unique dent in the universe that I was capable of making? And did I leave the world a little bit better place for my kids in the way that is unique to what I might be able to do? And Otherwise, at the end of the day, we're kind of just trouser-wearing apes floating around on a rock in the middle of nowhere. And so just enjoying the ride, I think, is important. So I think it's sometimes detaching a little bit and not getting so caught up in all the little stuff is an important thing. And I am actually relatively good at.
I know you have a book recommendation for us. Tell us what it is and why you picked that particular book.
It's called The Price of Time by Edward Chancellor. I'm a big Edward Chancellor fan. He's a historical economist. He looks at, writes up history of what was happening at different time points. He's got some of the great historical books to read if you're interested in finance. Devil Take the Hindmost is really good. I would recommend that one as well. But this most recent one that came out, there's a lot of focus on the last 10 years, but there's even more historical context for that. And he's looking at interest rates and what do they mean and what, how did they drive behavior? Who tried to control them at different time points in history? What were the outcomes? And so we like to think that we're living in a very unprecedented time period where, oh my God, we have these central banks that are doing these things. They're controlling interest rates. They're keeping rates low. It's actually not true. Like, it's happened in history. We've seen what happens. We've seen the speculative bubbles that get blown by low interest rates. And we've seen the heartache that comes after that and the price that you have to pay, the hangover that comes from having the party that's unavoidable. There's actually nothing new under the sun is what the takeaway of this book is. But, you know, he's a very clever writer. His word choices are interesting always. And his historical research is top notch. I think it is very important to understand what's happening now is to know what happened in history. And not that you know exactly where things are going to go, but at least gives you some idea of the range of outcomes that you might be looking at to know what's happened in history. And so that's my recommendation for getting a little bit smarter. And the good news is that he's such a good writer that he takes what could be a very dry subject, historical interest rates. Like, who wants to read about that other than two nerds like us? But he's such a good writer that he makes it very interesting. He talks about the characters behind it.
I'm curious if you found in the book anything that surprised you, that changed your mind about things. The cost of money and interest rates, was there anything that surprised you?
He talks a lot about this guy named Walter Bagehot, I think is how his name is pronounced. And he, in the 1800s, wrote for The Economist. And he was a commentator about central banks. And he said the equivalent of John Q. Public today, they had a different word for that back then. But John Q. Public can stand anything except for 2% rates. And what the idea behind that was is that anytime the interest rate got to 2% or lower, then people just started going out of their minds and doing stupid things with their money and investing in stupid projects. Like, and he details all these different projects that got funded that were just totally harebrained ideas. And he's basically saying it was the version of today that we would call financial repression, which is I can't find any safe way to invest my money, so I'm going to have to go out on the risk curve now. And that same thing was happening in the 1800s when central banks, then the Bank of England, was keeping rates down. This is exactly what we're dealing with for the last 10 years. And the surprising thing was that he was set at 2%. Like, we did that one better and went negative on a bunch of stuff, which to me makes absolutely zero sense from any kind of economic standpoint. I mean, negative interest rates, like, to me almost defies the laws of physics and entropy and anything that you could ever come up with. Like, you have to be very smart to come up with such a stupid idea as negative interest rates.
Well, what it means is that you pay somebody else to take and use your own money.
I'm not smart enough to understand such a genius idea.
No, I think it's quite the opposite. Jake, this was incredible. Thank you so much, and I really appreciate it. You were willing to go places where you and I have gone off record and have this kind of conversation with an audience. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Well, Buggy, as you and I are dear friends, and so I'm happy to chat with you any chance I get. So it's the pleasure's all mine.
And next time when I have a couple of questions with no answers, we'll do it all over again.
Well, if you don't have the answer, then chances are I don't have the answer. So we'll see where that goes.
Thank you, Jake. You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Sicard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Sicard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.